Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that last hour with Doug Gansler. I understand the angst and anger some people had during the course of that hour about the issues that face the state of Maryland and what is happening with our mortgages and HBCUs and the seeming power of the banks in the society of ours. So that is completely understood, something which we deal with here a lot, and we'll keep that going. You can call back at 410-319-8888, continue our conversation about that. My guest, Kwame Kwe Arma, has not arrived. I hope he's not lost. He should be here soon, and we were looking forward to having him on the air with us to talk about Ira Aldridge, which was going to be the topic of the day, and because he has done this incredible documentary from the BBC on Ira Aldridge, it is an amazing piece of work. Of course, Ira Aldridge is the man who the theater company here at Morgan was named after, the Ira Aldridge Players. And in the 19th century, he was born in New York City and became an actor. His father, he was born a free man in New York, joined the African Theater, the African Grove Theater, which was an incredible theater that existed in the state of New York, in New York City. It was burned down to the ground by people who didn't want the idea of a black theater in their midst in New York in the 1830s and 40s, and went to Europe and became this great Shakespearean actor. Some people credit him with creating the method that all modern actors use before Stanislavski ever did it. He was just really an amazing person. We'll play some of that for you during the course of this hour. But right now, just join us here at 410-319-8888, and we'll call this a little open phones before Kwame comes back to join us. And 410-319-8888, I think Leo, when he called in earlier at 410-319-8888, did really raise some issues about the HBCUs. And it's a very critical issue to this community that I think that Doug Gansler gave his response, but as being somebody who did not make the decision to go after them, but as the Attorney General, he had to go with the state, though some people have argued that the Attorney General is also the Attorney General for the people. And so it's a very sticky situation. And I think that in this world now, the time we're in, the state of HBCUs is in a very precarious position. What's happening now is critical to the future of those colleges. So join us here at 410-319-8888. We'd love to see your take on that. There are issues here we dealt with the other day, which I think are really important to our community, which has to do with ethics and the city of Baltimore. Not just the idea of skyboxes, where all the most powerful people in the city and friends of the mayor, who's ever in the administration, go to these skyboxes where deals are made and things happen. And I think that those are the kinds of things that that really rankle so many of us here in this community. And I think you need strong ethics laws to make these divided lines between those in power and those with power on the outside of politics who bring their power to bear. And I think no one's immune from that. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And we're looking forward to having you join in on this conversation. Whatever your thoughts on these and some other issues we can raise during the course of the hour. And let's go to Aaron in Baltimore.
Hi, how you doing, Mark?
Aaron, all I had to do is mention the mayor. I knew you'd call.
Well, first of all, this Grand Prix is a colossal failure, and I don't believe a word she said about it today. And quite frankly, the fact that she would give a contract to somebody connected with Constellation Energy tells me that she's insensitive to the people of this city. Not only that, with the Doug Gansler,
yeah,
the fact that he's opposing HBCUs as an African-American, I could never vote for him for governor of this state or re-election as attorney general of this state, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure he's neither elected governor nor re-elected as attorney general should he run for re-election as attorney general. Because he's shown me that as an African-American, he doesn't value my vote, nor does he deserve it.
So, I mean, the whole thing downtown with the race, you can start with that since you raised it up here. I mean, there's a lot of people who think that race shouldn't even be going on in the first place. That's the wrong place to put our money.
It shouldn't.
Right?
It was a colossal failure. And matter of fact, the fact that it failed in D.C. should have told them that it was going to be a colossal failure. And the very fact that this mayor is insisting on continuing it tells me that she's not only incompetent, but she's just downright idiotic.
Well, I don't think she's idiotic, but I think people play their politics, and she has the politics she's playing in the city, which has to do with things like that. I mean, you know, she's no brighter or less bright than anybody else who's running for office in the state of Maryland or the city of Baltimore. But
Oh, yes, she is, Mark. She's
there. Well, that's because you just...
Anybody who can put on the Grand Prix that was a colossal failure such as this can't be too bright.
Well, you know, I hear you, but I don't think that really is the issue.
Let me tell you, if she could put on an event where this city got stiff-armed and knowingly got stiff-armed, and go with the people she did to put this event on, tells me she didn't do right. And the fact that she's willing to go commit to another 5 years tells me she really doesn't have the sense God gave her.
Well, Aaron, it's always good to hear your voice. You know, you're always welcome on the show. Good to have you here.
Great.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. We're just going to let you take this conversation anywhere you'd like it. We are facing a great deal in this city right now and in this community. There are issues. I know some people are taking real umbrage at the issue around the equal rights issues for gays and lesbians to marry that have been raised in this show a few times. And I do hear what Darren was saying when he called before, that, look, I think that I can't think of a political candidate that we've had running for major office in the state, in the city, who hasn't had major money being backed by banks, developers, and that's real. I think that the deal we've just been talking about here with the Attorney General is – I mean, the biggest piece that's missing is what I questioned him about, I think, and that was the whole issue of why the banks are not being prosecuted for creating this financial crisis in the first place to put so many Americans out of their homes, so many Americans on the streets, so many Americans who lost everything they had with this bundling of mortgages and people taking out. That needs to really be dealt with, and that can only be dealt with really in many ways by folks who are the attorney generals of states where they have headquarters, like North Carolina, like New York, by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Those are the only folks who can deal with that. And so the question is, I think with this deal, they're not going to deal with it. And that is a deep part of the problem here. And your thoughts at 410-319-8888. I really want to hear what you think about these and other issues of the day. I am going to read this name right on my screen. Ashamak, you're on the air. Did I say it right? Ashamak.
Ahisamak,
I'm sorry, but I couldn't read it.
No problem. You did well.
Thank you.
My name is not the issue.
Well, go ahead, Ahisamak.
Going back to the Grand Prix, or going to the Grand Prix, if you have ever taken on a business venture, of any degree to accomplish something, you know, there's a whole lot of pieces involved, an awful lot of pieces involved. And there's some very smart people around that work on these kinds of things. And because the Grand Prix did not make the projections that was touted, does not mean it cannot with some tweaking. I mean, how is it that Baltimore is going to become a world-class city if we keep our heads in the sand? I mean, the mere fact that you make a projection and you miss it means that you're an idiot, that you're incompetent. We are our own Baltimore citizens, our own worst enemies, because these airwaves are going on all over the world. And folks are listening and say, this is how Baltimore thinks. I'm not relocating my corporate office here because they don't get it. And this is what I'm saying about so many people that are criticizing the mayor. I'm pretty much apolitical because politics is the game that everybody plays, whether they are aware of it or not. Everybody makes agreements. You negotiate back and forth. parents negotiate with their children. Children negotiate with their siblings, and so on. So let's not get hung up on the word politics. It's a job of managing a organization, Baltimore City, that has 625,000 people in it. You got to make decisions, and every decision that you make is not going to be right. I don't care who you are. You know, and Baltimore, to grow, has got to get up out of this small-minded thinking in order to turn some things around. And so that's my comment. And all the best to you, Mark.
You too.
Mark, and I'm saying this from the standpoint of a business owner. I started, and it is still going, and we're starting the sixth year of a nonprofit educational horseback riding program.
Oh, yeah. In Leakin Park?
Yeah.
Yes, right.
Right. And we have the same kind of verbiage that, oh, this is not going to work. People don't want to ride. They don't have money. They don't have this. They don't have that. But if the unemployment rate is 8% nationally, so what does that mean on the other side? What's the reciprocal of it? 92% of the people are working.
Well, yeah, but it's not that simple. I mean, because you're talking about in reality a much higher unemployment rate, because we don't count those who are no longer looking for jobs. The numbers of people in this country who have jobs where they have to work two and three and four jobs because they can't afford to make a living. And the fact that in America right now the wages are dropping and they have not grown since 1970. So that's real, and I think that.
If you want to live beyond your means, yes.
No. I don't mean to live beyond your means. I mean, Americans are losing money, not making money, in their lives, and I think that is reality. But the other thing you said before we go to some other callers, I mean, you know, people who came back from Europe that have been guests in the show during the Grand Prix, all they could talk about was that Baltimore had a Grand Prix. Because it blew their minds that another American city had it, because it's so huge there. And we'll see. I mean, I'm not one of those who was excited about the Grand Prix coming, but not excited about the idea of it, spending that kind of money downtown and tearing down the trees and the rest. However, it's going to happen. And if it doesn't make money next year, if it doesn't grow next year, if it doesn't do something for the city, then I think there's a real problem.
Well, you know, In the business models are after 5 to 7 years, if you're not making money or in the black, then, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree. What makes Baltimore City immune from that kind of analysis? What makes us immune?
Well, right.
That we got to bail out. That we can put the money in, and then all of a sudden we got to bail out. And not to use the
what?
If corporate America goes through the same thing. They build a product. They take years to
we're talking about the public money. There's arguments about how you spend the money we have in Baltimore, whether you spend it on a Grand Prix or whether you spend it on dealing with communities and making this a place to live for all people to live in. These are honest questions to ask. I think that calling the mayor an idiot for doing it, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. You're right. They're honest questions to ask. But we also have got to be willing to take some risks to move us beyond the quagmire that Baltimore finds itself in with respect to other organizations bringing their businesses here, their offices and factories and back office operations and things like that.
Well, so, Austin, Mark, let me be fair and get some other callers, though.
I really
appreciate it. And Wendy, I have to pay a visit to your spot, which I really like to see, because I'm glad you're doing it out there. And that's where I learned how to ride as a kid.
But we're at Liberty Elementary School. Is where we're going to be.
Oh, yeah, right.
In April.
Right,
okay,
right.
But Mark, I'll get you some information so that you'll know exactly where we are and what we're doing and what time.
Very
okay?
Cool. All right. Thanks.
Bye bye.
410-319-8888, whatever's on your mind. Kwame will be here soon. He is just around the city and got lost, but he'll be here in a minute. And Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Steiner.
How are you?
I was going to ask you for your opinion on the fact that New Mexico has requested that the federal government amend the Constitution to try to stem the tide of money flowing into the political system. And I wanted to get your opinion on that, you know, for you to elaborate on it. But before that, may I please say, I do get it. I do get it when I'm driving up the street in the rain and I can't see which lane I'm in, and all the traffic is moving in a dangerous pattern because everybody's trying to figure out where to swerve to or where to move to. When you paint those lanes in this street, which are numerous around this street, these dangerous conditions, then you can run the race all around the harbor all you want. I don't care, but make me safe first. And I'm not going to call a media bear an idiot or anything. Whatever her gender is, I don't know. But make me and the rest of my fellow citizens first before you decide to go into entertainment. Thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Clarence, I understand what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
I think that was at the bottom of the crux of this entire issue with the race. I think that it was handled badly in terms of who they hired to do it and didn't do their due diligence, which was a mistake. Even if you wanted the race. And on the other hand, what you said is right. I mean, we should be taking care of what is Baltimore first. We don't need that in this city. This city attracts people for other reasons, and and businesses lost money during the Grand Prix. So we do need to take care of our own streets first. And I agree with you. You can't see lines at night. Those things need to be painted and done better. And we could be using some of that money to take neighborhoods that are blighted and give it to communities to recreate themselves. So I agree with that completely. So, pardon me, whatever you think, please join us here, 410-319-8888. I want to hear your thoughts on that, on the conversation we had the other night here with three artists and activists who had some incredibly interesting ideas about what to do with this city and community of ours. And I'd like to hear your thoughts. So we'll be right back. Actually, Kwame's here, so the next thought will be about Ira Aldridge. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And before we jump into our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Numbers 1-800-638-7781. And if you're a first or second time home buyer in Baltimore, they have plenty of properties for you. So now's the time to call 1-800-638-7781. We are joined in studio by Kwame Kwe Arma, who is the artistic director of Center Stage, one of the world's great radio documentary and documentary producers, actor, director, playwright, and now he's running Center Stage.
Thank you for that. I will. I'll pay you every week if you can give me an introduction like that.
So welcome to have you, brother. Always
Thank
good
you.
To have you in the studio. So, folks, you can join us here, 410-319-8888. So, AQ and the others, we're not going back to the mayor's thing. So we're talking about something totally different, which is a man whose name is here at Morgan State University because the theater company here at this university is called the Ira Aldridge Players.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Ah.
So
that makes big sense.
It does. But many people don't know who this man is, lost to history in many ways to many people.
Yes.
Unless you're like a college student at Morgan and hear the name Ira Aldridge. And you did a documentary on him for BBC.
I did. I mean, I'd heard about him in London, mainly because he was renowned for being this magnificent Shakespearean actor.
Right.
And I was approached by the BBC and they said, you know, who would you like to talk about? And I kind of went, you know, we're living in a time of first, particularly then we just had Obama and, and different people were first, black cabinet minister, et cetera. And I kind of wanted to look at figures that we may have forgotten. And Ira, he played at the Old Vic Theatre. He played Othello, a theatre that I'd performed, a stage I'd performed on. And here was this man in the 1890s.
1830s. 1830s, 40,
right. 40, yes,
right,
yeah,
right.
Who who was on the stage, in fact, 1820s leading up, who was on a London stage and was playing these leading roles and being called a prince, being the great tragedy actor of his day. I mean, being second to Edmund Kean, who was the great tragedy actor in Britain at that time. And when he died on stage, you know, Kean whispering, I am gone. The next person on was this African-American actor coming onto the British stage to play Othello.
His history to me has always been, I've just always been fascinated by Ira Aldridge and what he did. And as you say in your documentary, he was born in New York, son of a free man.
Absolutely. And a religious man. A preacher, which is always makes me laugh, that he said to his father, you know, I want to be an actor. And he said, no, I want you to be a preacher. And I kind of think, you know, sometimes people can argue that's one and the same thing. And that he had to kind of run away to work with a theater company, a very prestigious theater company at the time.
And they burned down the African Grove Theater in New York, race riot against this African-American theater in the middle of New York City.
Absolutely, absolutely. What I find interesting about that is that it was an incubator, this theater. It used black talent to its fullest. Ira was like 17 when he would go in and he would look at these people who would be doing, sometimes it was fairly controversial, to kind of keep the money coming in, would kind of do coon shows.
Right.
To kind of keep their integrity and their artistry going, would do Shakespeare. And here were these people who could flip a coin and say, what do we want here? What do we produce? A real wonderful model of how you negotiate kind of a company, how you negotiate yourself in terms of one for them, one for me, one for them, one for me. And of course, you know, it was a big threat. And so it was burnt down by a rival producer. Well, actually, a rival white producer at the time.
Didn't want any competition. And didn't want to see black folks doing a better job than he anyway.
Absolutely. some would argue that. Some would argue that.
So he goes to England. So let's play a little piece of your documentary.
Okay.
Which one do you want to start with? We have these pieces picked up. This is a little back down in the story. But it has to do with Othello and the racist attacks. It just sets a tone of what he faced in England. This is the second cut we were talking about. Can you see that one? The one that's like 1 minute and 13 seconds. Let's play this cut. Comes out of the documentary on Ira Aldridge that was produced and done by Kwame Kwe Arma. So let's listen to this piece.
Othello was the role with which Aldridge came to be most closely associated, and which dominated his life. It is a play full of raw and racked emotions, hatred and prejudice, and it is in such terms that the play opens.
Soon, sir, you're robbed. For shame, put on your gown. Your heart is burst. You have lost half your soul even now. Now, very now, an old black ram is tupping your white ewe. Arise! Arise! Awake the snorting citizens with the bell, or else the devil will make a grandsire of you. Arise, I say!
Earlier this year, comedian Lenny Henry played the title role in Northern Broadside's production of Othello.
At the core of this play, which people don't like to talk about, is serious racism. And, you know, in the beginning, lots of racial epithets are thrown around. You know, an old black ram is tupping your white ewe. He calls Othello the thick lips. I hate the Moor. You know, the Moor is used in a pejorative sense, like, you know, calling somebody, a coon or a whatever. And it's the Moor is used in that way all the way through the play.
I am one, sir, that comes to tell you your daughter and the Moor are now making the beast with two backs.
What's really interesting about that for me is that here was this man who left America because he thought, I'll never be able to play the kind of characters that I want to play here. And so went to England, the heart of then in particular of the slave trade, the leaders. And he went and he kind of worked his way into the West End, into the most famous theatre of the day. And what's really interesting was Britain at the time was having a huge fight about the abolition of the slave trade.
Right.
The abolition of slavery, actually, yes. And so the West India lobby would use him, would attack him so viciously because they didn't want him to symbolise equality. to somehow be able to speak English in that way, to be able to use Shakespeare to highlight his humanity. That to the West India lobby and the pro-slavery lobby, that to have him on the English stage was somehow high treason. And they came after him. I mean, the reviews that he got in some quarters.
Oh, my God. Reading the thing, hearing what was in your documentary, the vitriolic racist attacks, just really vicious.
It was, I mean, so much so that he was driven from the stage after only two performances. And, you know, being someone who's left England and now come to America, it's really interesting that sense of, or that feeling of, I need to go somewhere. I need to travel in order to fulfill my potential. I'm not necessarily saying that was that for me, but I understand it. Mm-hmm. That he was then hounded off the stage is such a tragedy.
And of course, he as a black man in the 19th century England, playing Othello with a white Desdemona.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I mean, it was
instead of a white man in blackface, right?
Yeah, it was riotous. But here's the wonderful thing about him, is that he took the beating, as it were, and then just started touring the country and started playing all of the wonderful roles that he could find and was receiving huge reviews in Manchester and Southampton and created, then went, okay, I will create my own company. And, you know, if they won't accept me, I'll create my own company of both black and white, and became the toast of Europe. Here was a man who, from being kicked off the English stage, actually went and began to be to mix with kings and queens and be called almost and be treated like a member of the royal family.
Well, what's amazing to me is that sojourn he took, that you did so well in this documentary, the sojourn he took to Europe, to France, to Russia, to Poland.
Yes,
but everything changed. He fled America to go to England, to flee the racism of America, to try to see if he could become an actor and a free man in England.
Yes,
then he had to flee England to find his place as an actor by going to Europe.
Absolutely, and they embraced him. Now, whether it was exoticism, whether it whatever it was, that actually he became the toast of Europe. When I went to Poland and I went to Łódź, where the town where he was buried. And what was really interesting is that there's this picture of him on the grave. I mean, from right back then, that's still there. And he's in regal attire. And my translator, who was with me, a professor of English there, she found the grave and she was the one that identified it eventually. And but it didn't have his name.
Mm.
And as we walked in, she said she used to walk into the burial ground with her parents and they would look at this picture of this black prince and they would try and work out who he was. And they thought that he was this Ethiopian that had suddenly died on the way in. But actually, eventually she discovered that it was the great Ira Aldridge who would tour Europe and be celebrated and praised. And it's his tenacity that I admire so much, more even than his artistry. It is his sense of, I will not be beaten. I will not be defeated. I must fulfill my potential as a human being and as an artist, and I will go wherever I need to go in order to make that happen.
So it sounds in some ways, I mean, if you look at Ira Aldridge in certain ways, even in this 21st century, I mean, as an inspiration, as somebody who, a lesson to learn from, to hear a story that means something for now.
You know, he is an icon in the real sense of the word, sometimes forgotten icon, but he really is. I mean, even by 21st century terms, what he achieved is extraordinary.
Right.
By 19th century, in 19th century
1830s,
terms.
1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
I mean, you know, it's extraordinary that here was a man that could be the son of a poor man and end up being someone who is courted by kings and queens because of his talent, because of his tenacity, because of his brilliance. I mean, he was also, it's quite fun. You know, we often think about the 1990s and on, and we think about artists having to change their identities, like Madonna, and, you know, creating narratives around themselves and reinventing themselves every couple of years. But he also did that because he left here an African American, and by the time he got to Britain, he was kind of selling himself as if he were the son of a Senegalese king.
Which he did. I mean, yes. People thought he was that.
And people thought he was that, and right. He kind of went, yes, that's who I am. And there was this whole story around him that missionaries had come to Senegal and had taken him from there and brought him to Britain, this prince. And so all of a sudden he became the prince that everybody wanted him to be.
Did you ever read the piece about him that I read? Actually, there was one of the books about him. They talked about Charles Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
Having gone to see him
play
Othello, because Dickens was taken with, and Dickens, as the young Dickens, liked him.
Wow.
And they never had any proof of a relationship, but there's always this this subterranean thought that there might have been a relationship between the two men.
Oh, that's hilarious. I'll look that up.
I'll show it to you.
Please. I didn't know that. But it's wonderful, because he did take England by storm. And we have to remember that often when we think about England, we kind of think about Big Ben, men with bowler hats and a red bus.
But in Downton Abbey.
Do you know Downton Abbey, in fact? But actually in 1789, a little bit before, of course, he got there, you know, one in four of the population of inner London was black. And many of them were African Americans.
Nobody knows this. Say that again. Nobody knows. Few people know this fact at all.
1789, one in four of the population of inner London was black. And you just have to look at the paintings of Hogarth and you'll see the representation there. That's why I love him so much, actually. Hogarth. Because you go, oh, it does exist. It's not just propaganda. It's not just something that you've read. It is actually fact, and you can see it in the representations of the time and of the day. And so by the time we got to when Ira was in London, you know, London was a hot place of diversity. And again, it's not something that we think about.
We don't talk, no, we know who ever thinks of London in the 1700s, 1800s as being a place where black people lived, right?
Absolutely.
So I just, a little digression, I have to ask this issue. So, I mean, I know that are there people in London now, in Britain, people of African descent, Afro-American descent, that can trace their families back to that period?
Well, it's interesting. It's a very interesting question that you ask, actually, and a very fascinating subject for me. Because, really interestingly, 1789, as I said, one in four, by the time there's a new exodus from the Caribbean into London.
Which is where your family came, right?
Absolutely.
Right?
Which is just pre the First World War. That black community didn't meet the black community that existed in the 1830s.
Huh.
So literally within 80 years, 90 years, that community had died out or had integrated out. By the time my parents' generation came in the 1950s and 60s, they didn't meet the generation who had come during the 1911s and the early, that period. We know that there was a huge community then because there were riots in Liverpool, riots in Bristol, riots in London, racial riots. And they didn't meet them. So it's really quite fascinating. There are communities in Britain, in Liverpool and Hull, where there are people of mixed descent who have been of mixed descent for two or three centuries.
Wow.
And so that community
even
exists.
Today.
Yeah, even today. Swansea, Liverpool, Hull. So actually that's where the communities kind of found themselves and kind of stayed.
That's really interesting.
Yes, I find it fascinating.
That's a story in itself. That should be.
It is. It's a documentary.
It's a
documentary.
It is. Yeah, I love that. So going back to Ira Alger, which is one of the reasons we're here today.
Absolutely.
Because you're speaking. Is it this Sunday you're speaking at?
Yes, I am. I'm speaking next Sunday on Ira. I'm at the Pratt.
At the Pratt?
Yes.
Okay.
It is at the Pratt, I hope.
I think I'm going to look it up as
well. Yeah, look it up for me, I think. But yes, it's next Sunday.
So going back to where we were, I want to play this clip so that we can hear a bit more of this documentary, which I love. This is the third clip we have in a row here. It's called Precursor to Stanislavski, is what I labeled it. So let's play this.
Some people say that he was one of the precursors of Stanislavski's methods. Mm-hmm. He was so convincing that people thought that what he was doing on the stage is actually what's happening. There was a case once in Germany when a guy in the audience got up and he said, "You can't, you know, kill her. I mean, what are you doing, man? You know, somebody must stop you."
A wonderful testament to his quality of acting.
Really?
You know, it is, you know, that he was so deep in it.
Because in that period of time, a lot of actors were absolutely stylized.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Not into the character, into this moment of the place.
Absolutely.
But clearly he was.
Yes. I mean, you just have to look at photographs of Edmund Kean, his mentor, his role model, or, you know, probably the best actor, they said, at the time. You know, it was very, very arched. It was very stylized. It was very... And he was able, I think, particularly when he started touring Europe, he was able to kind of develop a kind of form of naturalism that was, I can't say revolutionary, Stanislavski was doing it, but a form of naturalism that was very attractive, that was very new for particularly English actors.
What I found interesting in your documentary that was also the piece about Ira Aldridge playing Shylock.
Mm.
Who was the Jewish character in Merchant of Venice.
Absolutely.
And how he played him and what he felt about his oppression through being, I think, who he was, a black man from America.
I mean, we find our humanity in both watching works of art and in performing it. And I can imagine that in order to do that, he was able to tap into a part of himself that really understands oppression.
Right.
That really understands or really understood what it was to be an outsider. Again, standing at his grave, I got a real sense of, and it's sometimes silly to say that, but I got a real sense of here was someone whose humanity led him to do battle with his environments. His humanity said, I refuse to be contained. I refuse to be placed in that box. He would often jump earlier on when he was in England. He would do there was a kind of shuffle, kind of step in fetch it character that he would play. Because actors of the day, you kind of had to do a kind of a tragedy, then you had to do a melodrama, and then you had to do a comedy. And you had to kind of jump between all three of them for an evening's entertainment. But he would never play the kind of step in fetch it massa character until he had played in the Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
Until he had played the role that said, I can be a master of language and a master of emotion. And then he would allow himself to be, you know, the kind of stereotypical. I don't judge him for that. I see him as someone who was negotiating his time.
In the context of time he
was in. In the context of his time, he negotiated it. Not only did he negotiate it, he said, take me on these terms.
It's just, again, to think not just because it's Black History Month, because I think Black History Month should be every month, but it is the idea that a African American man in the 19th century, the mid 19th century, became one of the world's greatest Shakespearean actors.
I mean, it's when I first heard about him, and again, and forgive me for jumping, around. It was during the 1980s in Britain, and often we were still, you know, on the whole, there were white actors blacking up to play Othello. And there he was, you know, a picture of him at the Old Vic, one of the premier theatres in Britain. A picture of someone who was doing it in the 1830s. And it was just the symbol of him that gave many of us hope, that said if it could be done then, there is no excuse why it can't be done now, why we can't be playing not just Othello, but why we can't be playing the leading characters that have been created.
Well, he played Shylock. He
of
played
course.
King Lear.
Absolutely.
Right?
Lear was a natural for him, particularly as he got older and slightly bigger, I'm told.
But that's one thing they also, because of the racism of time, they played on his physicality.
Absolutely.
To attack him.
Absolutely. They often spoke about his lips, though they said that he had a rather refined nose for an African, but his lips were huge, and it was because of the hugeness of his lips. I of course would call them full, but because of the hugeness of his lips, he probably would not be able to speak the English language properly. I have to say, that stereotype lived in Britain for a very long time. It was said to me by my headmaster, or my headmistress, rather, when I was about 12 years old.
No, really?
Oh, absolutely. They called my mother into school and said, you know, I would never be able to speak English properly because of the structure of the black mouth and the bigness of my lips. It would mean that I wouldn't be able to pronounce my words properly. And this was a fee-paying school that my mother was paying. My mother and father was paying, you know, money for me to attend. So if I faced that in the mid-1980s, can you imagine what he faced during the 1820s and 30s? Tremendous. As you said, this is not about Black History Month. This is about someone whose tenacity, someone whose bravery, someone whose artistry led them to define themselves and to defy their age and their time and inspire others centuries after they've lived.
So this is a wonderful documentary that we will link to on our website, too. And by the way, let me just say before I forget, let me tell people where you really will be speaking about this. And folks, the lines are open, by the way. This is live, 410-319-8888. Many of you out there who love theater and acting, and Kwame Kwayarma is the new artistic director of Center Stage, and we'll bring him on many times in the course of this year to talk about what's going to be happening at Center Stage in the coming season. But he will be speaking about Ira Aldridge, and it will be at the Walters Art Museum.
It's at the Walters, of course it is. Forgive me for saying the
price. February 26th, which is in 2 weeks.
Yes.
From 2 to 3:15 p.m. It's open to the public. February 26th, 2 to 3:15 p.m. at the Walters Art Museum downtown. Will you be playing some of your documentary while you're there?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. And thank you for reminding me of where I'll actually be.
Well, I want to make sure we got it right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I'll be playing a bit of the documentary. And I think what I'll be talking about when I'm speaking about him, actually, is not just the chronology, but actually what it means to be an artist maybe before your time.
Yes.
What it takes in order to define yourself against your age, and looking at what kind of artist he was, and actually trying to find modern analogies. Very interestingly, Idris Elba, who of course played Stringer Bell in The Wire, could almost be the equivalent, the 21st century version. He left London
to come here
to play. After feeling contained by London, by the acting community in Britain, and came to America and has become a superstar. He's a superstar. He won the Golden Globe the other day. He's producing, he's doing, you know. And it's very interesting for me. When I think about Ira, it's really easy to kind of go, oh, that was then, and that was America. But actually, you know, as I say, you know, Idris is to me the modern Ira.
We only have a few minutes left, so let me cut one quick call in. Sheila in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling in. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Sheila.
Yes.
Okay, you know, it sounds like you're talking about Paul Robeson, because as far as I know, everything that you're saying that has been mentioned outside of Paul Robeson's name is exactly what happened with Paul Robeson.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So it's, I don't see now, you know, Paul Robeson was, in fact, his voice was, you know, as an opera singer, ace, you know, Ira Elderson's ability, and he spoke 38 different languages.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, and of course came.
You didn't once mention Paul Robeson.
Well, because we've talked about Paul Robeson on the show before, but right now we're talking about Ira Aldridge because of the documentary that was made.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'll just take my, you know, that's what I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you, Sheila. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila. I mean, I think what's interesting about that point, and I'm really pleased that she mentioned it, actually, is that Ira, you know, he beat a path that others later would follow.
Exactly.
And the Paul Robeson analogy is absolutely correct, that Paul would also have to go out to Europe and survive in Europe because of not being able to fulfill his potential here.
And I'm glad you've made this documentary, and we're going to put it up on our website, which I guess is okay to do, so people can hear this and hear this conversation we're having now. And you can meet Kwame at the Walters Art Museum in 2 weeks on the 26th of February. At 2 p.m. to 3:15, Just come on into the auditorium. He's there, and it'll be an incredible afternoon, so you do not want to miss it. I'm not going to miss it. And Kwame, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
It's good to have you in the studio
again. It's lovely to be with you.
So I'll remind you all as we go out of here that coming up next after me is the Urban Health Beat. Marilyn Harris-Davis looks at orthopedics, and Dr. James Wood is her guest. John Tegler is Jazz Straight Ahead, comes after her show. And the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Cricket Arison. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our intern is Liz Walker. Reggie Tucker is our engineer. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and to find out information about our guests and the work they are doing, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for WEAA Public Radio 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.